Time Warner Audiobooks presents Handbook for the Soul, edited by Richard Carlson and Benjamin Shield. Read by Blair Brown and James Coburn. Author and lecturer Marianne Williamson's best-selling books include A Return to Love, A Woman's Worth, and Illuminata, Thoughts, Prayers, Rites of Passage.
Foreword by Marianne Williamson. I can think of no other time when it has been more important to consider the needs of the human soul. The 20th century has been dominated by a worldview that glorifies a mechanistic, rationalistic focus at the expense of the inner life. The ravages that have been wreaked on the planet as a result of this dissociation from the essential self have reached crisis proportions. Yet just as the individual unconscious knows when a person's survival is threatened, I believe the collective unconscious knows when group survival is in danger. Beyond the level of the rational mind is an awareness that without our souls, we are without our power. And without our power, we will die. Carl Jung said that the psyche is inexorably driven to seek balance. I believe that modern consciousness is now seeking its soul, not because it's a new trend, but because it's literally our only survivable alternative. This book speaks to a yearning for balance, a mass willingness to rekindle our souls. This may represent a more important historical unfoldment than we as a culture have known for centuries. All the great religious and philosophical systems are paths to this understanding, different yet equally valid paths. And spiritual ideas, like any ideas, are strengthened as they're shared. For those to whom many of these ideas are new, our hope is that they will fill you with wonder and delight, as they surely inspired those who wrote these pages. And people who are already quite familiar, at least intellectually, with this ageless wisdom, can join other pilgrims in sharing it, embracing the ideas even more deeply, making them part of our daily spiritual practice, and trying to apply them to all we say and do. Our soul is our life. Everything else is a fiction, a mind game, inauthenticity. Without nourishing our own souls, we can't nourish the world. We can't give what we don't have. As we attend to our souls, we emanate invisibly and involuntarily the light we have received. The book is dedicated, then, to increasing the spiritual potency in each of our lives, so that what begins as individual nourishment might become nourishment for our communities and for our countries and for our world. As the ancient mystical doctrine, the Kabbalah, says, we receive the light and then we impart it, and thus we repair the world.
Psychologist Nathaniel Brandon authored such books as The Psychology of Self-Esteem, The Disowned Self, and The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem.
Passion and Soulfulness by Nathaniel Brandon, PhD. When I think of nourishing the soul, I think of nurturing the ability to respond positively to life. That is, the ability to sustain passion for our interests, values, and projects. I believe that the worst of all spiritual defeats is to lose enthusiasm for life's possibilities. Every life has its share of setbacks and disappointments, of tragedy and loss. So the question we all confront in the face of negatives that may assail us is, how do we keep our inner fire alive? Two things at minimum are needed: an ability to appreciate the positives in our life and a commitment to action. Every day it's important to ask and answer these questions. What's good in my life? And what needs to be done? The first question keeps us focused on positives. The second keeps us proactive and reminds us that we are responsible for our own happiness and well-being. Another aspect of focusing on the positive, and thereby nourishing the soul, is to stay focused on the inquiry, what in my life do I most enjoy? What most stimulates me? Someone once said that you can know who a man is if you know what wakes him up. The pleasures that nurture me personally may be as simple as enjoying the view of the city and the ocean from the window of my living room, or spending time in the garden, or appreciating good health. Of course, one of the greatest joys that nurtures me is having a loving relationship with my wife. In addition, when I think of nurturing the soul, I think of listening to music and rereading books that have meant a lot to me. I also think of the act of writing. When I spend time at my computer writing, I almost invariably experience a tremendous sense of appreciation of how wonderful it is to be alive. If I'm away from writing too long, I feel discouraged or at least dispirited. Writing takes energy, and it also creates energy. For all of us, the key is to pay close attention to what activities make us feel most alive and in love with life, and then try to spend as much time as possible engaged in those activities. Even when our life is most difficult, it is important to remember that something within us is keeping us alive, the life force that lifts us, energizes us, pulls us back sometimes from the abyss of despair. True spirituality does not exist without love of life. If we feel unhappy or unfulfilled, the most urgent question is, what needs to be done? Or one might say, what's missing in my life, and what can I do about it? The sin is to suffer passively. We must never forget that we have the capacity to act. So we must always be concerned to know what avenues of action are possible to me. What can I do to make my life better? If we stay oriented to the two basic questions, what's good in my life and what needs to be done, and strive to respond to those questions appropriately, the predictable result is that we will be happier human beings and get far more of whatever it is we want in life. Some writers, Eric Fromm for one, contrast a so-called being orientation with a doing orientation. The implication is that being and doing are in some sense antithetical. Of course they're not. Doing and being, action and stillness, are dependent on one another. Without action, we would cease to exist, and without stillness, we would neither be able to appreciate our existence nor have a foundation from which to act. We need stillness. We need the pure experience of being in order to fully realize ourselves. Out of that stillness can come the motivation to act and also the awareness we need to act wisely, not to lose perspective. When being and doing are in harmony, when stillness and action are friends to each other, we create an integrated, satisfied soul. We are then in the best position to truly enjoy and appreciate life and not be destroyed by adversity. Another aspect of nourishing the soul is the ability to stay focused on the present, to live in the present. Many years ago, in the 1960s, I was writing a book called The Psychology of Self-Esteem. I was a young man at the time, in my 30s, and one day I was sitting at my typewriter, impatient for the book to be finished, thinking that my life would really begin to unfold only when this book was finished. Yet I intuitively knew that there was something wrong with this line of thought. So I asked myself what I thought I would be doing when the book was finished. And I immediately answered, planning the next book. And when the next book was finished, planning the book after that. I saw that my life first and foremost was about writing. That was and is my passion. So in the middle of writing The Psychology of Self-Esteem, I finally realized, this is it. This is my life. If I can't enjoy it now, every day, there is no reason to believe I'll be better able to enjoy it in the future, after the 7th, 8th, or 9th book. That realization was a turning point for me. The impulse to focus on the future can be quite strong. It's natural to look ahead. Yet I realized that the key to happiness lay in enjoying the process, not just the final result. because the greater part of my life was going to be spent at the level of process and not at the stage of contemplating the finished product. So now I bless each day I get up and go to my computer and sit down to write and know and love the fact that this is what my life is about. I believe that earning your living doing something that you enjoy is one of the very best ways to nourish yourself. But even if you are employed at something that is not your ideal work, it is important to find ways to take as much pleasure in it as possible. Living in the present moment can make ordinary activities more interesting and joyful. You may be surprised if you only look at what you will find. If you try to stay connected with why you're doing what you're doing, for example, then even the parts of your life that aren't especially interesting can become more meaningful. Sometimes I have to go to an event that doesn't especially interest me. I've learned to tell myself, make this experience as happy for yourself as you possibly can. Once that becomes a conscious purpose, it's amazing how imaginative one can become. Life becomes infinitely more interesting. Nothing I am saying about the importance of living in the present denies the value of being concerned with the future. We want to keep in mind our goals, what we're moving toward, and to see the progression and direction that underlie our activities. We need to be able to plan for the future without sacrificing the present, and enjoy the present without making ourselves oblivious to the future. Obviously, we cannot control every single aspect of our life. We are not omnipotent, but we do have an enormous degree of responsibility for the shape our life takes. We have many options about how we will respond to events. We are not passive spectators, but active contestants in the drama of our existence. We need to take responsibility for the kind of life we create for ourselves. How do we nurture the soul? By revering our own life, by treating it as supremely important, by reaching for the best within ourselves, by learning to love it all, not only the joys and the victories, but also the pain and the struggles.
Philosopher and essayist Robert Fulghum wrote, "All I really need to know I learned in kindergarten. It was on fire when I lay down on it. Uh-oh. And maybe, maybe not."
Pay Attention by Robert Fulghum. Although the purpose of this anthology is to explore the notion of nourishing the soul, I must begin by confessing that soul is a word I rarely use. I understand that within the context of Christian theology, the soul is the immaterial essence of a person that precedes one's earthly existence and continues after that existence has concluded, but this is not the meaning of soul as I would use it. I don't want to lead anyone to think that I believe in a separate entity called the soul that needs care and feeding as does the family dog, although I would never quarrel with anyone who uses the word soul in the classic manner. I'd like to find a different way in which to talk about what the word soul means to me. If someone were to ask me whether I believed in God, or saw God, or had a particular relationship with God, I would reply that I don't separate God from my world in my thinking. I feel that God is everywhere. That's why I never feel separated from God, or feel I must seek God, any more than a fish in the ocean feels that it must seek water. In a sense, God is the ocean in which we live. The same attitude applies when it comes to discussing matters like soul, spirit, heart, and mind. I don't divide myself from these things. They're not separate from me. But in the same sense that we use the word mind to talk about a particular function of the brain, I can use the word soul or spirit or heart to talk about a particular function of my life. I use these words to describe a particular set of activities in my life. Soul is found in the quality of what I'm doing. If my activities have a sense of truth and integrity, if they are deep in meaning, then they are rich in soul, and so am I. Thus, for me, nourishing the soul means making sure I attend to those things that give my life richness and depth of meaning. Rather than launch into an abstract discussion of the philosophy and theology of enriching one's existence, I'll tell you about a day in my life. Certain activities, structures, and ritual patterns have become woven into the fabric of my daily life because they have been so consistently useful to me, because they nourish my soul. I arise about 6 o'clock every morning. Instead of turning on the light or the radio, my wife and I light candles or oil lamps. We like to begin our day with this softer, gentler light. We listen to music as we build the fire in the fireplace, especially in the winter. After the fire has been built, the next hour of the new day is spent in talking to each other. These morning rituals bring us into the day in a gentle, nourishing manner, so unlike the hurried, panic-stricken way we begin our days when we were much younger. Now we open our day with a consciousness of attitude. We're together. We pay a lot of attention to each other. After breakfast, I go to my office, where I have what an anthropologist might describe as an altar. I don't call it that, but it's a place on top of a cabinet where I put things of importance. Right now, there's a brick on my altar. As I look at it, I remember walking along the seashore in Seattle. Right along the edge, where the water and the shore meet, I found this brick. And this brick had a history. It was once earth. At some point, fire and water were added to the earth, then it became a brick that was used in a building, perhaps someone's home. Eventually, the building was torn down, and the brick was cast aside, becoming a bit of rubble on the beach. As I was walking along the water's edge that day, I saw in this ordinary object the eternal pattern of our lives, the coming and going of use, of the coming and going of energy. A Buddhist would say that I saw the Buddha nature in that little brick. I don't think of it that way, but I understand what it means, that this brick is a physical metaphor for the processes of life. And so, as people often do, I picked up an interesting object and brought it home, putting it in this place where I look at things that have meaning to me. It's been there a while now. In time, I suppose it will be pushed aside by something else. I think that we all have consciously or unconsciously placed items like this in our houses, something we have picked up while walking along the beach, or a leaf we have found during the change of seasons, or a flower, or a fruit. I enjoy lighting incense every day, as much for the sensory smells as for the gesture of fire. Rather than using oriental incense, I found wonderful incense smells from my own culture, mesquite, cedar, and pinyon pine. The smells remind me of quiet evenings by the campfire, sitting outdoors in nature in a thoughtful state of mind. The incense I light is not a symbol of prayer to the gods, as in Eastern religions. Instead, it's a way for me to recollect fine times in my life through smells that bring to mind pleasant memories. Sometimes during the day, I consciously focus on some ordinary object and allow myself a momentary paying attention. This paying attention gives meaning to my life. I don't know who it was, but someone said that careful attention paid to anything is a window into the universe. Pausing to think this way, even for a brief moment, is very important. It gives quality to my day. Through many years of trial and error, I have learned that my conscious brain is efficient for only about an hour. No matter what intellectual task I'm performing, my performance begins to deteriorate after about 60 minutes. Forcing myself to continue does not improve my performance or add to the pleasure of the task. So every hour or so, I get up and do something else, especially something physical. I'll go out and pick up firewood, or carry out the trash, or go for a walk. I'll do almost anything that gives my brain a break and employs my physical sensations, my eyes, my ears, my nose. By the time I come back to work, I'm cooking again. I have also learned that my intellectual activity is strong in the morning, so that's when I turn my attention to the day's thinking tasks. I never force my brain to do what I know that it does not do well in the afternoon. Instead, I focus on physical activity, task activity, and mindless things. And then, I do something that you would not be surprised to hear I learned in kindergarten. I take a nap. I lie down in the afternoon and quiet myself for a half an hour. Napping improves all the other aspects of my life, and my wife says the world is better for it as well. I don't always sleep, but I've learned that if I just be still for a half hour, I may enjoy the feeling of meditation or prayer or simply restfulness. Perhaps sleeping isn't as important a goal as stopping. Stopping the thoughts and the pressures. After my nap, I usually walk for an hour. The walk is exercise for my body, but also a time to forego consciously trying to do anything with my brain. I leave my thinking mechanisms alone. I let my mind wander. I talk to myself as I walk, and I sometimes talk out loud. I'm always surprised at the thoughts that pop into my head at inopportune times. I've learned to carry a very small tape recorder and a pencil and paper with me as I walk. I pay attention to ideas that appear in my mind during these walks. I'll sit down and take notes, or I'll talk into the recorder, or talk out loud to myself. Sometimes I have an unexpected feeling of connection with the universe, with the seasons of the year, with what's going on in the world, and with what's right in front of me. All of a sudden, I'll have a deep emotional experience because I gave myself an opportunity to have feelings, to let things happen in my mind as they will. Letting go of life's deliberate activities allows me to see what my subconscious wants to do. And so I nourish my soul by paying it careful attention. Later in the day, as we sit down to dinner, my wife and I hold hands before we eat. As we look in each other's eyes, we tell each other without words that we love each other very much. That moment of stopping and holding hands is a powerful statement of affection and well-being. If we have company, we tell them that the finest blessing of any meal is to share it with friends and invite them to join us in our ritual. After dinner, my wife and I do the dishes together, often singing as we do. We'll begin singing as we wash the dishes, and then we sit down, not for too long, to play my guitar and her auto harp as we continue harmonizing, not too well, unfortunately. This is one of the loveliest times of the day. Singers are those who love to sing. Before I go to bed, I always go through the house, closing the doors and turning out the lights. Then I sit down in a rocking chair in the living room for a few moments. I sit there in the dark, collecting my thoughts and trying to focus. I have no purpose in this. I couldn't describe to you, or even to myself, exactly what I'm doing, other than to say it is a deliberate effort to allow the pace of my life to slow down and to let things happen in my mind. To end the day, I do a funny thing before I go to sleep. I read something humorous in bed. Joke books, cartoon books, I read anything to help me go to bed with a laugh in my mind. This annoys my wife because sometimes I get to laughing and shaking the bed, and then I have to read her the story or the joke. So there's what I do every day that I can. I must confess, however, that I don't always manage to do all of these things or even any of these things. For all my good intentions, there are days when things go wrong or I fall into old habits. When things are not going well, when I'm grumpy or mad, I realize that I've not been paying attention to my soul, and I've not been following my best routine. But if I stick to my routine regularly, even 4 days out of seven, my life goes well. I have a weekly ritual to complement my daily rituals of paying attention to my soul. For 50 years, first as a child, later as a minister, I went to church almost every Sunday. For about the last 10 years, I have not been active as a minister. Still, I try to observe the Sabbath in two ways. First, I visit churches. Some Sunday mornings you'll find me at the Greek Orthodox Church, even though I'm neither Greek nor Orthodox, because I love the chants, the aesthetics, the whole richness. Or I might go to the very last compline service at the Episcopal Cathedral, which is a 30-minute sung liturgy with no sermon. And going to these churches, I am consciously putting myself into a place where richness comes to me in a way that's beyond words. My wife and I also try to live Sundays as if they were a different kind of day. I take this concept more from the Jewish tradition than from the Christian. We don't go anywhere. We don't have any obligations. We don't do any work. Instead, we listen to music. We read. We go for walks. We try to set ourselves aside from our busy lives on this day, allowing ourselves to simply enjoy being alive. We've noticed that having one sane day a week really makes a difference. We don't always manage to observe the Sabbath in this way, but when we do, it is indeed a special day. And so, every day I make a conscious effort to wake gently, relive pleasant episodes in my life, participate in physical activity, do meaningful work, let my unconscious mind speak to me, and focus. One day a week I set aside as a Sabbath. All of these simple yet rich rituals nourish my soul. If I fail to do these things, I don't sleep well and my days do not go well. The older I get, the more I realize the importance of exercising the various dimensions of my body, soul, mind, and heart. Taken together, these aspects give me a sense of wholeness. I want to be a whole human being rather than one who limps on one leg because I don't know how to use all of my parts. Intellectual, emotional, and physical activity are not separate entities. Rather, they are dimensions of the same human being. All of this takes some conscious effort. At the same time, I am fully aware of the extraordinary power of the unconscious. As I write these words, for example, some part of my brain is controlling my liver. If I were to take over conscious control of my liver, I'd be dead before this page was completed because I don't understand how my liver works. Yet, somehow, I cause it to function. This same split with unity is true for the activity of my whole being. If I were to attempt to rationally run every aspect of myself, I couldn't. The conscious part of my mind simply cannot control all the mysterious activities of my humanity. I don't have all the answers, and I certainly do not live a superior life. But there are some things that one begins to figure out after almost 60 years of life. Life often goes well at this point because we have made our mistakes and survived our failures, and because we know what it's like when life goes wrong. One final thought on nourishing the soul. I try to make sure that I see the real news of the real world that's right in front of me, not just the recitation of disasters that passes for news on television. The real news, the knowledge of what's going on in my immediate world and my immediate life, sustains life. I ate today and was not eaten. All the people in my world treated me with great civility and respect today. This news is nourishing to the soul. It should be sought out and welcomed. Now, I'm not a Pollyanna. I know that bad things do happen. As I look across the room, I see a very large poster hanging on my wall that shows a chicken being held upside down, about to have its throat cut. Underneath the picture, it says, "Don't forget, sometimes things are just as bad as they seem." But right alongside that is a rubber chicken, and looking at it makes me laugh. I guess the key questions to ask are, what do you expect out of life, and what would you settle for? I don't expect that anyone's life will be lived exactly according to plan, but I do expect that life will go well if I simply pay attention to the positives as well as to the negatives of the mixture that is in me and in the rest of the world. And if I focus on my soul, if I allow it to speak to me, and if I listen to it carefully, then it is I who am nourished at the center of my being.
Stephen R. Covey has lectured and written extensively about leadership, personal and organizational effectiveness, and relationship. His best-selling books include The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People and First Things First.
The Guiding Conscience by Stephen R. Covey, Ph.D. To me, the essence of keeping the soul nourished is obedience to one's conscience. I don't think that the soul can be nourished unless people have a strong sense of conscience that they have educated and developed and soaked in the universal and timeless principles of integrity and service. This way, the individual soul becomes part of the universal soul of service, contribution, and making a difference. You need to take your private victories and make them public. Much of the self-esteem literature has created a kind of narcissism of taking care of the self, loving the self, and nurturing the self, and has neglected the next step, service. If you don't have a public challenge, then your private victory may be just a lot of heart massage. You think you're nurturing your soul because it feels warm and cozy, like you're taking care of yourself. You may be good, but what are you good for? You've got to be good for something. You've got to be about some project, some task that requires you to be humble and obedient to the universal principles of service. You've got to live a life of complete and total integrity in order to give this kind of service. This integrity enables you to love other people unconditionally, to be courageous and kind at the same time, because you have integratedness inside your own soul. Most often, a major external challenge or project, some Mother Teresa kind of project, is necessary to bring this integration. What does this integration involve? I see the soul as the primary essence of our true nature, our spirit self. When all the parts of the self, the intuitive system, the feeling system, the senses, the conscience system, the value system, the habit system are in sync, then the soul becomes the dominant force in your life. When this happens, you start to see the potential in other people. You affirm them and you help them see that they can make a major contribution. And so the goodness starts to spread, one person to another. Our firm, Covey Leadership Center, has just produced a little film on a young man in Uganda by the name of Stone, who was a great soccer player. Someone purposely blew out his knee in a soccer game, ending his professional career. He could have chosen bitterness, but instead he began to help other young men who were aimless and without direction, who were on drugs, in gangs, doing nothing. First, he gave himself to building them up by teaching them to be soccer players. Once that relationship was established, he helped them develop skills and crafts so that they could make a living and then become responsible fathers and community contributors. What he has done is truly inspirational. You could see how his own soul was nurtured by his desire to contribute, to focus outside himself. This kind of soul development comes after you have acknowledged some great need that is external to yourself. Then, in order to respond effectively to that need, you find yourself needing to go within and nurture and develop your soul. Then a beautiful process begins. Responding from the soul, you become truly empathic and sensitive, very patient and very aware of the reality of the other person's need. The other person begins to get a sense of your vision for his or her possibility, and you affirm his goodness, her potential. An inside-out growth process begins for both of you. One soul can be an island of excellence in a sea of mediocrity this way. And that one soul can change the whole sea. One soul can stop the transmission of bad tendencies from one generation to the next. One soul, let's say, was abused as a child. But she doesn't have to abuse her child because there has been a reconstitution of the soul. This comes through tapping into four unique human endowments, which all people have. The first of these is self-awareness, the ability to examine your own life, to stand apart from it, and study the scripting inside you. The second is your power of imagination, your vision of how you can create a better situation for people, for yourself, and society. The third endowment is your conscience, a deep moral sense of what is right and wrong. And finally, you have independent will, which you can exercise to act on the other three endowments. It is when these four endowments are exercised on a regular basis that the soul develops deeply and starts to reach out to influence other people. A person who chooses this path is literally a change catalyst. I call them the trim tabbers because they're like the little trim tab on the rudder that moves the rudder, which in turn moves the big ship. One soul can make a whale of a difference in any environment that person is in. Look at German psychiatrist and author Viktor Frankl's experience as a prisoner in the death camps of Nazi Germany. Look what Nelson Mandela has done for South Africa. 27 years in prison, and now he forgives and has become a charismatic, mature man. He's another Gandhi. People like these inspire the Gandhi in all of us. This work can begin no matter where you are. I think that the most significant work we ever do in our whole world, in our whole life, is done within the four walls of our own home. All mothers and fathers, whatever their stations in life, can make the most significant of contributions by imprinting the spirit of service on the souls of their children so that the children grow up committed to making a difference. For myself, the key thing, again, is the education of the conscience. Personally, I choose to prayerfully study the scriptures every morning and every night. I get up early so I can be alone, to have what I call a private victory, a moment of clear understanding of what my life is about. As I exercise on my stationary bike, I study and plan my day of service and contribution. Then I try to put that plan into action during the day. I try to have some meaningful, rich time with my family. I help my children with homework, or go to their basketball games, or whatever they're involved in, and spend time with them. I listen to them. We have our scripture reading at night. Then we pray, because we rely so much on God and on the power that comes from Him and the way He can nurture our conscience. We are also very active in our church on Sunday. We renew our covenants with God through our church program and with our involvement in service projects. Often, people get pulled away from the soul's guiding principles. We are living in a hurried world, in which instant success is the watchword of the day. A sense of urgency develops, and we often develop an addiction to the intensity and pressure. Much in our lives seems urgent, yet is not important. I believe that if you build up the important areas of your life, the urgency will pull at you less and less, and your life will feel more focused and purposeful. To me, the things that are truly important include building relationships, empowering other people, developing a vision, and nurturing the soul. I call the process of developing these important areas sharpening the saw. And we do it in four areas: the physical, the mental, the social, and the spiritual. Focusing on these four areas will eventually let you see how much in your life is irrelevant, how much you can say no to. The transition to emphasizing the important over the urgent is a difficult process. People seem to have withdrawal pains as part of moving away from the pressure. But once you get into focusing on importance over urgency, the benefits are enormous and satisfying. If the people I work with move to this way of thinking, they'll start talking to other interested people, beginning with their families, then work groups, and so forth. We have seen entire organizations move to this kind of thinking in just this way. In fact, real benefits to the marketplace come through this process. The pragmatic fruits are becoming increasingly obvious. I think it's primarily because you cannot survive in a global economy with low quality, and you cannot produce high quality unless you have high trust. So it is also impossible to have high, sustainable trust unless you have deep trustworthiness in the people of that culture. Now, getting people to focus on nurturing the organization's soul brings about this sort of deep character development. Everything is driven by these values and by this truth. Humanity is the mother of all virtues. When you are humble, you accept that there are certain principles that are external to self, that we must align ourselves with. Each person is not a law unto himself. Natural laws define how we nurture our souls. These laws are universal, covering cultures and religions and nationalities. As people cultivate these principles inside themselves and develop the service ethic, the desire to make a difference, to help the dispossessed and disadvantaged, grows. These natural laws and the logical outcome of obeying them reflect how we belong to each other. We are sisters and brothers in the family of God, and therefore we are of each other's nature. So even though I don't know you in an earthly way, in a deeper sense I do know you and care for you, and you for me. This is where we meet and where our connectedness nurtures our souls. I'm convinced that soul nurturance depends on our having a vision for ourselves and our world. I think that the recovery literature has focused too much on understanding the scarring of our souls from abuses of childhood, and not enough on vision. I'm convinced that vision is infinitely greater than baggage. We have within us tremendous capability and potential for actualizing that vision and eclipsing the baggage. Mind you, I'm not against the self-awareness that comes from talk and insight therapies. I just don't think it's sufficient. It's not transcendent enough. We can't think small. We have to think about outside contribution. That is what changes and heals people. An internal structure within us supports this process. I think of it as a little family. The mother of the little family is humility, which says, I am not in charge. I must submit myself to the governing principles. The father of the family is courage, because it takes tremendous courage to overcome the deep psychic scarring and scripting of your own nature, to overcome the powerful social forces that aren't aligned with the governing principles. The child of that union is called integrity. That is the place where our soul is rooted, around a set of balanced, timeless, universal principles. Finally, there are two grandchildren. The first is wisdom, meaning that you can see the larger picture, how things are related to one another. The second is abundance mentality, which says that you know your security comes from within, not without, that life includes ever-increasing resources. Our service to others then opens the soul. When other people suffer from soul sickness, we can seek to build relationships by understanding their world and their feelings so that they can feel deeply understood. Then we begin to affirm them, their potential, their innate power and goodness, and then they might be open to being taught to be independent, so that the student becomes the teacher and more souls are touched. Several dimensions are critical to our capacity to do this work, to develop our capacity for soul. Leaving out one dimension has a domino effect upon the others. We need to balance these dimensions. There is the physical. People who don't have control over their flesh will eventually find that they won't be able to get control over their spirit. Their minds, their passions, their appetites will control instead. Then there is the mental. We need constant development of the mind, including professional development, so that we continually improve our ability to think deeply, analytically, creatively, conceptually, and abstractly. And then, of course, there is the spirit. The whole cultivation of one's conscience and spiritual sense. I had an experience in Mexico that dramatically illustrated how the process of maintaining soul connectedness works. I don't speak Spanish, so at this event I had on earphones with simultaneous translations of the speeches. I could hear the English translation through the earphones while at the same time hearing the speaker. And I thought, this is how it works with the soul. You're experiencing the sensate world outside yourself, but if you have cultivated the soul, you also hear a small, deep, inner voice that helps you understand and interpret your world, that directs you so that your conscience, not external social mores, becomes your guide. Just as I could shift my consciousness between the Spanish voice, which I didn't understand, and the English voice, which I did, we can shift our consciousness from the confusing externals to the clear directives from within. As long as there is this balance between the inner and the outer, our soul is nourished, and we can live a life of service.
This book is continued on the other side of the cassette.